Last week we began a series in the book of Esther, so we went through chapter 1, which I would probably call an introduction, so we can find out what's going to be happening, because nowhere in that chapter were Esther or Mordecai or any of the other people of God mentioned. It was just kind of an introduction to see what it would be like, perhaps, to live in that kind of society in that time, living in Persia, and it would not be unlike Daniel and his friends living in Babylon, which would have been just even a few years earlier. But at this point, this man named Xerxes, or in some of the translations, his name is Ahasuerus, and he is the one who is the king or the pharaoh. He's the one in charge. He gets whatever he wants. And so today we want to look at this introduction now of Esther as she comes into the story and who she is. And so this series is really titled and is revolving around this idea of being right on time. And if you've studied Esther before or even familiar with the book, maybe one of the themes or one of the statements that you may remember is, "For such a time as this." And that was one of the words. We'll get to that eventually. That's not even going to be today. But God has a way of working things out, of working his plan, that his kingdom and his people, he is watching over and he is directing the affairs of what's happening. We know that God is all powerful, that God is still present in our lives and in our society. And even way back then in Proverbs chapter 21, there it says, in the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water, and that he channels toward all who please him. So even the king's heart, it says, is like that of channels of water that the Lord directs. And so all of these things are not happening just coincidentally, but God does have a divine plan. And so today we're going to see this idea, the introduction of the star, the one who's going to be the star in this story as it continues to be revealed to us. And so we're going to go through just a few verses as we understand what's happening in this chapter. But before we do that, maybe a little bit of history would help us to know how we got to the point. And if you remember in chapter 1, we see Xerxes wasn't very happy with his wife Vashti because he was having a big drunken party with the boys or with the guys, and he wants his king, the king wants the queen Vashti to come and to parade herself before all of his drunken friends, and she refuses, and he's very upset, and he asks his counselors and his legal attendants, what should we do? And they're thinking, well, if the queen gets away with this, who knows what it's going to be like when I get home with my wife? And so they said, you know, something's got to be done. And so they decided to banish the queen and say, we're going to make a law now to say that all the women must honor and obey and please their husbands. And we kind of have an idea how that works out. It didn't work back then. It doesn't really work today when you legislate to women how they're going to be treating their husbands. That's another story. But this is the condition, this is the situation, so we know it's going to be difficult now. So here's the history of what's happened. They've just kind of come out of Babylon. A lot of people have already gone back to Jerusalem. Some people have actually gone to Cyrus, which would have been Xerxes' father, and now even to Xerxes, and they're working things out that they're rebuilding the temple under Ezra. They're going to be rebuilding the walls under Nehemiah. All these things are happening over in Jerusalem because you remember they were in Babylonian captivity for 70 years. That 70 years is over and some have been allowed to leave, but some stayed in Persia. Some stayed in Susa, the capital. And these are the people we're talking about, the people that stayed. They've not gone back to Jerusalem. But there's something else that's important so that we can maybe get inside of Xerxes' head a little bit, because he's already done this with his queen Vashti. He's already banished her. He's not chosen another queen. He has a lot of women. He has concubines. He has a harem. You know, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But that's the way it was back then. But he wanted a queen. But before he got to this point, there's something else that happened. We're going to find out that history says that Xerxes reigned in his kingdom from about 486 BC till about 465. And then we find out Queen Vashti, chapter 1, verse 2, says it was in the third year of his reign. So what we're doing here is simple math. For me, it was not quite so simple, but it's simple math. It's 3 years, okay? So we're counting down 3 years. Now, another thing we're going to find out in our story today, chapter 2, this is Queen Esther. Chapter 2, verse 16 says it was in the 7th year of his reign, right? So the difference between the 3rd year and the 7th year, 4 years! He's gone 4 years without a queen. What else happened? Search the Bible. We don't find out anything else that happened. But look at history. What else happened with Xerxes during this time? It may show you a little bit of his frame of mind. He went out and in a big battle, first of all, he sent men out, then he sent ships out, but he was completely defeated. He won a few of the small battles, but ultimately he lost the war, lost thousands of men, and came home defeated. He didn't overtake Greece as he had hoped, and I'm sure as he planned, and told everybody how powerful he was. Last week we saw the breadth of his empire, 127 provinces. Okay, so it was a very large empire, many people. But now he's defeated at Greece, and this is maybe as he's coming home, or maybe even a few months after he gets home. But this is what happens when he's at home now. He's not very happy, okay? He had a little problem with his wife. Now he's had a big problem with his military. Now he's back at home. And so this is kind of the entrance into the story. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, and we're reading into that saying to do with his wife, but maybe there's more to it than that as we've just seen, he remembered Vashti and what he had done and what he had decreed about her. This sounds a little bit like regret. It's not like, oh yeah. It's like, wow, I really wish I hadn't done. I wish that she was here. I wish, you know, because she was a good person. You know, whatever kind of relationship he had with her. And again, probably it's more than just sexual, because again, he is the kind of person that is quite involved with many different women, whoever he wants. That's the kind of power and position that he has. But he remembered Vashti, and he's thinking, well, there's got to be something else. My life is a little bit empty. What else can we do? And so then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. And so now they're saying, let's go out through this vast empire and find women that we can choose from, and we'll find another one to replace Vashti. We can find a queen. I mean, there's enough women around. This can't be that complicated. And if you're familiar at all with the empire, I don't think it was a voluntary thing. Let's all just sign up, whoever wants to come. These people that were sent out, these administrators, were pretty serious. I'm thinking their idea was, if I find the winner, I would be richly rewarded. I will have a name for myself. I am the one who is the contract bearer of this person. You know, she is under me. And with the king's power, he can tell women what to do. He can say, you're a young woman, you're not married, they had to be virgins, you're going to come. Even if it's against their will. Because this is not going to necessarily be a luxurious position for these women. They're going to be a part of his harem. One will be chosen queen, but probably the rest of them will stay in the harem, which means they may never really see the king again. Sure, they'll be able to live in the palace, and their needs will be met for the most part, but to be torn away from your family? And maybe for some of them, never to see their family again? That would be very hard for a young woman. Some of these women probably are teenagers, or young teenagers. And so now we're going to find the most beautiful woman. And to us, that sounds a little bit barbaric. That kind of sounds immoral. That sounds like something, well, who would ever do that? What kind of society would ever gather together women so they can parade themselves and show off what they got? And it's all based on their own personal beauty. What kind of immoral, despicable society would do such a thing? We are only in our 20th year of The Bachelor. Which is basically the same thing. Let's just parade these women. It's all about their looks. It's all about their sex. You know, it's just all about that. Now, maybe again, if you'd realize what it may be like for some of these women, again, young women, I don't want to speak down to some young teenage girls, but sometimes they can be a little bit of infighting. You know what I mean? Especially when they're competing for a position or especially if they are very beautiful and they've been told their whole life how beautiful they are. So they've kind of got a chip on their shoulder and they've got an attitude and, you know, all kinds of things are changing in their lives. And so, yeah, they may not be that easy to get along with anyway. But this is the kind of society it was. It's like, let's find the next Miss Persia. Yeah. Right? That's what it is. Just a huge contest. It's not really based on much. But I think as we see through the story how God is planning and putting things into place, that things will actually happen. That this rose, I wonder who would get the rose. That's kind of how they did it on The Bachelors. Whoever gets the rose. So the idea is you get the rose, you get to marry the king, the big guy. Just another side note, I never watched The Bachelor, but I thought I'd better look just to know what I'm talking about a little bit. Out of the 19 seasons that have already happened, there have only been two that have resulted in marriage. The whole show's about finding someone you'd actually marry. And so here's a guy getting able to choose and to pick between all these beautiful women, and he's like, yeah, they may be beautiful. I'm just not interested in marrying any of them. Right? You think there's more to it than just the way somebody looks. But this is the way it's going to be even in this kingdom. And so we'll continue reading. Verse 3. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. So we're going to gather up all of these women. We are going to put them all together. They're going to be spending time together. They're going to be preparing. There's going to be these beauty treatments. And so there's kind of a system already in place, but now we're going to add to it. So there's going to be a big search. Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world, right? And if you see her, actually, you know what that song's about? A guy who realized what he's lost. He had somebody who was very beautiful, somebody he loved, and he just let it go because of choices and decisions that he had made. But this is the idea. We're going to find someone that's the most beautiful. And she can now be given to the king. And so here's this man named Hegai, who's in charge of the women. And basically, that's why he's a eunuch. If you're not sure what that is, speak to your parents. They'd be happy to explain it over lunch. So here they get all the women together. This big protocol, all the preparations, all these things going on. And now we're introduced now to somebody else named Mordecai. Just a couple of verses earlier, we find out that Mordecai's great-grandfather is the one who was living in Jerusalem when Babylon came and fought against Jerusalem, brought back the captives or the slaves back to Babylon. And so what we're saying is this man named Mordecai had been living in Babylon his whole life. Now it's called Persia, but he's very familiar, as were his parents. It's kind of really all he's ever known. This system and this government and this way of life. And you know, you could say, well, maybe he's made his home there. Maybe he's comfortable there. And I know you may have Bible studies on this and people say, well, they should have been gone back to Jerusalem. You know, why didn't they go back with the remnant, with the faithful? Why are they still here? We don't know all the answers. And maybe this is part of the providence of God. Maybe he thought he could do a work here. Maybe he was, to a certain degree, involved and some of the goings on here, even in the community or even in the politics. But his name was Mordecai. And he had a cousin named Hadassah. This girl, this is the young girl. This is Esther, actually. Hadassah. Hadassah is her Jewish name. Hadassah. Hadassah means myrtle. A myrtle tree. A myrtle tree is a flowering tree. It's a very fragrant tree. It's a very beautiful tree. So even the Jewish people, her parents recognized that she was a beautiful person. But the myrtle tree is also a symbol in the Bible of God's love and grace. The myrtle. And this is who she was, a very lovely and a fragrant young girl. And she had been brought up by Mordecai because her father and mother had died. We don't know how they died, but again, she's probably fairly young here. But so, as far as she knows, Mordecai is really her father, her stepfather. And we know that they were indeed only cousins. This girl was also known as Esther. Now, Esther would have been her Persian name. And Esther actually means star. She's a star, and the idea is that she's not going to be the star. Now, again, maybe they called her that because she was radiant, but in fact, she's actually going to become a light. She's not going to become the star of the show, but she's going to become a light that's going to shine for God, to the people of God, for the glory of God. She's going to be one who shines. She was lovely in form and features, which basically means this. She had a beautiful face, but she also had a beautiful figure. In other words, she was beautiful all around. I mean, some people can have a very beautiful face, but their body's not quite as beautiful. Other people, maybe a beautiful body, face. There's been a few songs in the past by those British rockers about that kind of thing. We won't get into that. We won't be singing any of their songs. But sometimes that happens. But she was beautiful all around. Everyone recognized this. Everyone could just see. And so she was chosen. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So here's this woman, a beautiful woman, and you know that she is one of these that are going to be chosen. Verse 9 says this. The girl pleased him and won his favor. And this is talking about one of the eunuchs that's in charge of the harem. And he recognized her. The girl pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned her 7 maids select from the king's palace and moved her and her maids to the best place in the harem. And so, you know, you almost see this being like a picture of somebody like Joseph, right? Almost somebody who's insignificant, but people recognize who he is. Now Joseph, although he was young, and I'm guessing Joseph was fairly handsome too, but that wasn't really why they were chosen. They were chosen because there was something about God working in their life. Joseph was the kind of person, although his circumstances were very challenging and difficult, he still cared about people. He was still willing to serve. He was still willing to let God use him. He wasn't this bitter, negative, you know, antagonistic person. Joseph was somebody, you see him, you say, this is someone that's a good person. This is someone who's responsible, somebody who's faithful. I can trust him. And I think maybe Esther was a little bit like this too. Not only was she beautiful, but I think she had a personality, a disposition. We're going to find that, you know, when she respects Mordecai. We're going to find out that she was willing not to reveal her heritage, her nationality. She was not telling anybody she was Jewish. The reason she did that, Mordecai told her not to. And she respected. I mean, once she was in the harem, she could have thought, well, Mordecai would never find out. And who's Mordecai anyway? He's never made it this far up, you know, the political ladder. I mean, I've got power. I've got friends. I've got influence. I can do whatever I want. She wasn't that kind of person. We actually find out by the time she went to see the king, she was submissive enough to her manager, we'd say, to this eunuch, that she says to him, well, what do you think I should do and what should I take when I go before the king? She's always asking. She's always willing to be taught. And she wasn't one of these really proud, arrogant, snooty kind of people, even because of their looks. She seemed very humble and teachable. She seemed very kind. And maybe that's what won the favor. It just wasn't her looks. It was who she was. It was her disposition. I don't know exactly what this would have been like. Maybe some of you may know. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months, we would say, at the spa. I mean, some people go to the spa for the afternoon. I mean, you maybe know what it is to have a manicure and a pedicure. I mean, this is 12 months at the spa. Right? We want to make sure that we've done everything we possibly can to make her as beautiful as we possibly can. So 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil and myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. I don't know. The 6 months with oil and myrrh, that kind of leads to 6 months of prunes, not perfumes. But anyway, you could only imagine what they went through, just so they could be presented to the king. So somehow they could win the attention and the favor and maybe even that final decision from the king. And so she went through all of this just so she could present herself. Chapter 2 in verse 15. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. Now you know that's difficult. I mean, you can win the favor of some people. You can win the favor of maybe some friends. But this is really saying she won the favor even of her rivals, even of the other people that may have been competing. Maybe the people that didn't even know her that well. She won the favor of everybody because of who she was, not just what she looked like. And I think there's a big lesson in there for us that we think, well, you know, people may respect me or like me because of my looks or because of my education or because of my money. But what about for who I am? Is that not what's more important? And when we think about our lives, what are we trying to attain? What are we trying to get? What are our goals? Well, I just want to be rich so I can be respected. You know, or I just want to be smart so people will notice me and they'll at least listen to me. Those things might be all right. I doubt they'll ever get you to the goal that you're looking for. But maybe it would be much wiser to say, what kind of person can I become? Not what can I have. What kind of person? What kind of character? What kind of personality? What kind of person inwardly could I become that people may respect me, that I may find favor? And yes, people may not always like everything you say and that you do, but they still may respect you. They may still give favor. They may say, well, I wouldn't do it that way, but I respect them. I'm respecting that they're willing to take a stand. I respect them that they're still humble. I respect that they're still loving, even though they may think differently or be differently than what I am. We can still find favor with people. And this is the position that Esther was in. And now we're going to find out that she found favor with the king. And so she was like everyone else. She had to go in to see the king. And this is what the next verse says in verse 17. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women. And she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And so here's the final choice. Here's the rose that's given to Esther. She's going to become the next queen. Just a couple things as we draw this to a close then. She was put into a position. God had provided this for her. God had opened up some doors. I mean, God is the one who made her beautiful from the very beginning. God put her in a certain time, in a certain place. So she was chosen. And she rose up to this position. And a lot of us may say, but I've never had that kind of opportunity. You know, I've never, you know, had the influence to be able to get into that kind of position where I could make a difference. But the fact is, God can use anyone. I mean, she had a lot of things against her. I mean, she was young. She was not Persian. Her parents had died when she was young. There's a lot of reasons that, hey, this will never work. Who is she that God could use her and God could work through her? But she was willing to let God work. No matter who we are, we may have opportunities in our life, but what do we do with them? How do we let God work? Or do we let things in our past knock us down to keep us from moving forward, to keep us from letting God use us to our fullest potential and to His greatest glory? Do we do that because of things in our life? Bad things that have happened to us? Now, you may have studied this before, and some people say, well, what kind of person was Esther? I mean, she wasn't like Daniel, because Daniel stood up and he let everybody know that he was a Jew. And Daniel said, there's no way I'm going to bow down, and there's no way I'm going to quit praying. And so Daniel stood for what's right. And no matter how you cut it, no matter how you read it, I mean, I know you got to read between the lines, but when Esther on her first date with the king, it was from evening until morning. And I don't think they were playing cards. Well, what kind of person would do that? Could God use a person that compromises like that? Although I wish I would have a study with some of these people that make a big deal out of that. It's kind of like, well, actually, could we read the Old Testament and find out how many of the men actually were sleeping with other people that weren't their wives? Hello. I mean, I'm not saying this is a good thing to do or she was justified in it, but yes, she probably did that. Well, what do you think? Do you think God can use people that have even made wrong choices? That have even sinned, whether it be in a moral way, sexually, or maybe sinned in breaking relationships or being disobedient or a lawbreaker or just whatever it would be. Can God use something like that and redeem it so that God can still use sinners? Oh, we're going to find out in Esther. Yes, God can still use us. He's not given up. He's not given up on his plan. He's not given up on us. So we can still have hope. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know what opportunities are going to unfold. But I need to trust God. I can't let my past hold me back. I can't let my fear stop me from moving forward. But I can let God use my situations, my opportunities, no matter what they are. Up to this point, reading the story, you may think, but it's all insignificant when it comes to the kingdom of God. But could God work through little things that eventually work their way into big things? Seemingly insignificant, but end up being life-changing. Oh, not only for Esther, not only for the nation of Israel, but for you and I. Because there's going to be a battle in the book of Esther. We're going to get to that next time. A battle for life. That's what we see on the earth. A battle for life of a whole race of people. But if that whole race of people are exterminated in a Holocaust, there's no salvation for you and I. Because the blood of Christ from Abraham would have been destroyed. So God's going to work. Seems insignificant even so far. But bigger things are going to happen. And I hope that God continues to work in our life. And a bigger prayer would be that we would actually allow him and let him do his work that he's wanted to do. We're going to sing a song. I bring my sins to thee. Just submitting ourselves before God, saying, God, I want you to use me. I want to be a part of your plan. I want to be a part of your kingdom. And that just means we've got to rid ourselves of ourselves. To say, I'm not going to live for me anymore. I'm going to live for Christ. I'm going to repent of my old way of living. Living for me. Living selfishly. Living in sin. And I want to live for Christ. Being baptized when we call upon the name of the Lord. If today we can encourage you in your Christian walk, or if today we can help you become a child of God, or if you want to study more about the plan that God has for your life, let's stand together. We'll sing this song and let us know how we can serve you today.